Well, as you know, yesterday, if you were here, we looked at the book of Ecclesiastes, and I suggested from the end of the book, from chapter 12, verse 11, that Solomon has employed these key phrases that mark out the sections of the book. So there's a question at 1:3, what does the worker gain from his toil? And then that question is repeated at chapter 3, verse 9, what does man gain from all his toil? And that sort of marks the first unit of the book, chapter 1:1 through 3:15, as dealing with that question, what do you get out of your work? And that first section is going to correspond to the last section of book of the book, which is marked out by the phrases in chapter 11, verse 9, where Solomon writes, "Know that for all these things God will bring you into judgment." And then the very last verse of the book, 12:14, God will bring every deed into judgment. So it's kind of like the first section asks, what do you get out of your work? And then the last section says, know that you're coming into judgment. And then the second part of the book, starting at 3:16 and running through 6:12, really deals with the question of injustice, the problem of injustice. And Solomon's answer to that problem is, God is going to judge. But the problem is, how do you bring people to know that God is going to judge them? So at the end of chapter 3, 3:22, he asks the question, who can bring man to see what will be after him? And then that question, who can bring man to see what will be after him, that's also the last question asked at the end of chapter 6, in chapter 6, verse 12, who can bring man to see what will be, who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? And so it's like Solomon is trying to say, you really don't want to engage in injustice and oppression because you're going to stand before God and face judgment. You're going to have to deal with the consequences of your actions. And who can help you realize this so that you fear God and you don't engage in this injustice? And then in corresponding to that is the section of the book that we're going to look at today, which is going to start at chapter 9, verse 1, and continue through 11, 6. And here, the big idea is that man does not know. But before we look at that, I want to say something about the central part of the book, and that's 7:1 through 8:17. And I just want to draw your attention, we looked at this yesterday, but I just want to draw your attention to the way that in 8:17, three times Solomon says, man cannot know. So I'm just going to read Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verse 17. He says, then I saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. So that idea of not being able to find out all the work of God, that's the controlling idea of the central part of the book, 7:1 through 8:17. Complementing that is the section that we're looking at now that's related. So the 7:1 through 8:17, man cannot find out. This section is going to be dominated by the idea man cannot know. So what Solomon is going to do is he's going to talk about how we can know some things, but there are a lot of things that we can't know. And acknowledging our limitations in what we can know and acknowledging the finitude of our understanding, he's going to recommend how to live in response, how to respond to the fact that we can't know everything. So the first section, it's going to start in 9:1. And notice how in 9:1, near the end of the verse, he says, man does not know. You see that phrase there, whether it is love or hate, man does not know. And then this section ends in 9:12, and you notice how 9:12 starts with, man does not know his time. And I'm not going to take the time to read through every verse of 9:1 through 12. I just want to show you how it starts and ends with this assertion, man does not know. And then I want to summarize the various kinds of things that we can't know. So look there in verse 1. He says, all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. So what he's getting at, I think, is the way that God is sovereign over every aspect of our lives. And then he says, whether it is love or hate, man does not know, both are before him. I think what he's communicating here is there's a sense in which we don't even understand our own responses to things. We don't understand why we love certain things, why we hate other things. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know. And then in verse 2, he's going to talk about how all people experience, they have similar experiences in life. And in a sense, we don't understand our times. And then look down at verse 11, where Solomon gets at the inexplicable reality that life is unpredictable. So I'm going to read this verse, and then I'll just give you one illustration of it. So 9:11, Ecclesiastes 9:11, again I saw that under the sun, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all. So Solomon is saying, this is the way life sometimes works out. The weak sometimes prevail. The slow sometimes win the race because of God's sovereign orchestration of human affairs. Verse 12, for man does not know his time. Like fish that are taken in an evil net, like birds that are caught in a snare, so the children of man are snared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. Here he's talking about the way that sometimes people unexpectedly die. They die when they seem perfectly healthy, and maybe they get into an accident and they perish. Or they seem young and strong, and altogether unbeknownst to everyone, there's a disease that is destroying their lives, and suddenly they die. And the statement there at the beginning of verse 12, man does not know his time, is communicating to us. We don't understand, and we can't predict when it is that our day is going to come. This is part of the human condition. So how do we respond to this? How does Solomon want us to respond to this reality? I think that in 9:7 through 10, he's communicating to his audience how we ought to respond to all that we don't know. So I would invite you to look at chapter 9, verse 7, where he says, go, eat your bread with joy, and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Now, we talked about this briefly yesterday. I think that Solomon is addressing the believing remnant within the nation of Israel, so that when he says to them, God has already approved what you do, he's assuming that these people are like Abraham, and they have believed the Lord, they've believed God's promises, and God has reckoned their faith to them as righteousness. So because they're righteous by faith, and because their hearts have been circumcised, and they want to do what the law commands, they want to please the Lord, they want to love God, they want to love their neighbor, as a result, God has already approved what they do. And then those instructions, go eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart, this is like a recommendation that they enjoy what they still can experience of what life was like in the Garden of Eden. So if we were to go back, as we did yesterday, and look at Genesis 2, 15 through 25, in that passage, the Lord puts the man in the garden to work it and keep it. Verse 15, he tells him he can eat freely of every tree in the garden. Verse 17, tells him he can't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Verse 16, then verse 17, he can't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Then he makes the woman for the man and blesses them. And here, it's like Solomon is saying, even though you don't live in the Garden of Eden, you live in the fallen world, even though the transgression has happened, by faith, you can still walk with God, you can still enjoy God's goodness, and you're not going to understand all your emotions and responses to things, 9:1, and you're not going to know the day of your death, 9:12, but this is how you should respond to life. You should eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart. God has already approved what you do. And then he says in verse 8 there, let your garments be always white. Let not oil be lacking on your head. And what I think he's saying is something like, don't save your good clothing for the special occasion. And don't save your cologne or your perfume for the special occasion. I don't know about you, and maybe this is just a function of me having grown up poor, but I have a bottle of cologne at home that I've had since I was in high school. Because I think to myself, oh, I don't want, that's expensive stuff. I don't want to use it. I want to save it. And it's still sitting there, and I'm 51 years old now. I've had it since I was like 18. And Solomon is saying, enjoy your life. Maybe you have this experience. I have white t-shirts at home that I think to myself, if I wear that and wash it, it's going to be yellow before long, and I want to keep it white. And so there it sits in the drawer. It doesn't get worn. And Solomon is saying, let your garments be white, and let not oil be lacking on your head. Go ahead and enjoy your life. Verse 9, enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of, I would translate this something like, your life of breath. I don't think he's saying your life is meaningless, your life is vain, your life is pointless. I think he's saying your life is a life of breath. It's a life of vapor. It's going to be fleeting. So enjoy it. And he says, enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your life of breath that he has given you under the sun, because that is your portion. Now, this bit about enjoy life with the wife whom you love, I think what he's saying is, don't live like you don't enjoy your life. You know, some people, maybe you read C.S. Lewis like I did, and C.S. Lewis said in one of his writings something to the effect of, I'm convinced that some people like to be unhappy. They want to complain about things. And so no matter the circumstances, no matter the arrangement, they've always got something negative to say. And it's like Solomon is saying, okay, we can recognize that there's always something to complain about. There's always something to find fault with. And instead of looking at life that way, you should take the posture of, I'm going to find something to be grateful for. I'm going to find something to enjoy. I'm going to be a person who's positive, and I'm going to enjoy life with my spouse. And then he continues there in verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. So all of this, I think, flows out of Genesis 2, 15 through 25. Adam was put in the garden to work and keep it. And it's like Solomon is saying, do your work with all your might. Go after it. Work and keep the garden that God has given to you. It's not good for the man to be alone. Enjoy what God has given to you in a spouse. You may eat freely of all the trees that are in the garden. So eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with this expression, with a merry heart. You could translate this with a good heart. And I think what he's getting at is the way that it's like what Paul says when he says in Titus, to the pure, all things are pure. If you have a good heart, you can receive a glass of wine and you cannot proceed to drunkenness, and you can receive it with a good heart, and it's going to only do good for you. And I think that's what Solomon is commending. So that's that first unit there. And I think what he's saying is, you're not going to understand all your emotions, chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. You're not going to know the day of your death, chapter 9, verse 12. And chapter 9, verse 11, you're not going to know why it is that some people win and some people lose. So how do you respond? Chapter 9, verses 7 through 10. You enjoy the life that God gives you. This next section, the second section, I think is bracketed by the phrase in 9:13, I have also seen. And then if you look down at verse 7, I have seen, of chapter 10. So 9:13 and then 10:7 both start with the phrase, I have seen. And I think that those two phrases bracket this material, 9:13 to 10:7. And what he's going to commend here is the pursuit of wisdom, which is not surprising to us at all, because Solomon's trying to teach wisdom to his audience. So by talking about wisdom, what he wants is for his audience to look at these examples that he's going to give and to learn to be wise. So 9:13, he says, I've also seen this example of wisdom under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it and besieged it, building great siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor wise man, and by his wisdom he delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that poor man. Now, by telling this story, Solomon is trying to provoke our thought. He's trying to provoke our intelligence and activate our intellectual faculties so that we ponder this and we then look at our lives and say, are there ways that I don't recognize the ways that people benefit me? You know, if we think about the history of Israel, there's actually an occasion where David was on the run from King Saul, and he actually defeated a Philistine contingent of forces that were coming against this small city called Keilah. This is back in 1 Samuel 23. He delivers this city, and because Saul is trying to kill David, even though David has just defeated the Philistines and delivered the city, Saul then comes and besieges the city. And David cries out to the Lord, and he says, will the men of Keilah hand me over to Saul? And the Lord reveals to David, yes, they're going to hand you over to Saul. And so David flees the city of Keilah. And we look at that, and we say, that city did what was wrong. That city should have defended David. They should have appreciated the fact that David delivered them. So also, we should look at our lives, and we should recognize the way that people benefit us, people serve us, people make our lives better, and we should appreciate those people. That there's wisdom in that. We should not be the kind of people that presume on others, that take the service of others for granted, and that don't appreciate what is done for us. So there are all kinds of ways that this applies. You know, we should appreciate the members of the armed forces that defend our lives and that make it possible for us to live in freedom. We should appreciate, you know, I serve at a seminary, a school. I should appreciate the deans, the vice presidents, the sacrifices of the president of the school, all of which make it so that I can show up to class and just open the Bible and start talking. And they make my life possible, and I should appreciate what they do for me. So there are all kinds of ways that this applies in our lives. Verse 16, I say that wisdom is better than might, though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard. Now, this is a thought for us to ponder, isn't it? We can think back to things like the Maginot line that the French prepared in World War II. You may remember, because of the way that World War I played out, there was this long trench, and the two sides, the French and the Germans and the British and everybody, they were all just fighting over that long trench. And so the French prepare this huge concrete and reinforced line of defense against the Germans. And what did Hitler do? He got his tanks, and he just went right around the Maginot line. This is what Solomon is talking about. Wisdom is better than might. And this is something for us to ponder. We don't want to just, in our lives, build up this big defense that was for the last war or the last problem that we dealt with. We want to be shrewd. We want to be aware of what is happening around us, and we want to apply wisdom. Verse 17, the words of the wise, heard in quiet, are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. And I think this is probably coming out of the context of the city and the battle. And you can imagine that poor wise man, he's not like a king before the army, stirring them up to try to fight off the enemy. He's quietly, shrewdly giving directions about how the city can be defended. The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. Now, all of that, I think, is kind of Solomon's way of saying, you should appreciate wisdom. You should value wisdom. You should cultivate wisdom. You should seek wisdom. And now what he's going to do next in chapter 10, verse 1, is issue a warning. So he says in 10:1, dead flies make the perfumer's ointment give off a stench. So a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. Okay, so this is a comparison. This is what dead flies do to the perfumer's ointment. And then the way the comparison works is he says, this is the way it works with a little folly against a lot of wisdom. And I don't know if you're paying attention to college baseball like I am, but maybe you saw that the head coach of Wake Forest University, they were playing the Tennessee Volunteers the other night, and the Tennessee Volunteers, I cannot stand the way they play baseball. They are the most infuriating team in college baseball. But wisdom recognizes they're trying to provoke us. They're trying to get in our heads, and that's what they're doing. So the Tennessee Volunteers, they're just a nasty bunch of people. I mean, I forgive me if you're a Tennessee Volunteers coach, but I cannot stand those people. I can't stand their coach. I can't stand their players. They have terrible attitudes. They gripe about every call. They stall the game. I mean, most college baseball games take about 3 hours. If the Tennessee Volunteers are playing, it's going to be a five-hour game because every pitch, the batter's going to step out of the box and he's going to adjust his batting gloves. He's trying to get the pitcher out of rhythm, and they're just infuriating to the opposing team. And so maybe you saw that the Wake Forest coach, he uttered a string of expletives that was caught on camera in response to one of the Tennessee players. Now, What's ironic about our culture is that they don't care about any of the expletives as long as they don't have to do with race or sexual orientation. But if you cross the line and you say something racial or you say something about homosexuals, you've crossed the line into the territory where you might not recover from this. You might not keep your job. So I think it's the case that the head coach of Wake Forest University baseball, his job is in jeopardy because he said one of these words, one of these verboten words. And it's exactly what's being talked about here. Dead flies make the perfumer's ointment give off a stench. That guy has won and won and won and won and won. So much so that they're in the regional final against Tennessee. And he says one word wrong and that's it. My junior high basketball coach in the state of Arkansas, his son was now he until midseason he was the head coach at the high school where I played my 10th grade year, and he used one of these words. He was out. His team was on the way to winning the state championship. He used one of these words with reference to his players. You can imagine what it was, and that was it. They removed him from coaching. The team went on to win the state championship without him, and he didn't get to be there. And he's not going to coach that team anymore. He's done. Dead flies make the perfumer's ointment give off stench, so a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. And what Solomon is saying is you need to recognize the impact of one foolish word, one foolish act. I mean, think about Adam in the garden. He transgresses that one command, and that's it. He's out. And this is what Solomon is getting at. So he's commending wisdom and then pointing out the ramifications of folly. And he continues in this way in chapter 10, verse 2, where he says, "A wise man's heart inclines him to the right, but a fool's heart to the left." Now, I looked into this, you know, when I was studying this, and I would love to tell you that in ancient Israel, the right was associated with conservative positions, but I'm not certain that's the case. I think the point is wise people go one way and fools go the other. I think that's what's being communicated. And this is part of Solomon's instruction. He's everywhere urging people to choose wisdom and to recognize folly and to stay away from fools. Don't let bad company, as Paul puts it in 1 Corinthians 15, corrupt good character. And then he says in verse 3, "Even when the fool walks on the road, he lacks sense, and he says to everyone that he is a fool." What he's communicating, you know, if you have some wisdom and you know how things work, You can take one look at people sometimes and know that person is a fool. That you just know from the way they're walking across the street, that's a fool right there. That is not a wise person. And Solomon is pointing this out and urging people to recognize what's before their face. Verse 4, "If the anger of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest." I think this is related to what he had said in chapter 8, verse 3, where he said, "Be not hasty to go from the presence of the king." And I think what's envisioned here is if you are, in that context, he's urging people not to get caught up in conspiracies against the authority of the king. And if you're somebody who's caught up in a conspiracy against the king, you're going to feel guilty. And as a result, if the king communicates any kind of suspicion, you're going to want to flee. And Solomon is encouraging that you have a purity of heart, purity of motive, so that if suspicion rises in the king, you can stand there with boldness, with clarity, and be guiltless before him. And I think that's also at play here in chapter 10, when he says in verse 4, "If the anger of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your place. Stand firm. Don't flee, because then you look guilty. Stand there and stand up to him." I know some volatile leaders, people in high position, and if when their anger starts to rise, the thing to do is not to run. That just makes them madder, and that just makes them conclude, okay, that person is no help to me. When their anger starts to rise, and these are explosive people who, you know, your life is sort of in their hands, the thing to do is to stand firm and to be calm and to speak clearly and to offer the best wisdom that you've got to try to solve the problem. And that will actually raise you in their estimation. And I've seen it happen. I've seen there was an occasion when a friend of mine was standing before my boss, and my boss's anger starts to rise and he starts to get volatile, and my friend just calmly, steadfastly talked him down. And this is exactly the kind of thing I think Solomon has in mind here. Verse 5 of chapter 10, "There's an evil that I have seen under the sun, as it were an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in many high places, and the rich sit in a low place." Now, I think he's assuming here that the rich are rich because they know how to work, they're diligent people, they're good workers, they're productive, and so wealth naturally accumulates to them because they're wise, good stewards of what God has given to them. So the rich are the worthy rich. Meanwhile, folly is exalted instead of these people. Solomon is pointing this out so that his audience will recognize this and try to remedy it. Solomon is pointing this out so that his audience will recognize, I should elevate those who are actually people of character and capacity. I should not elevate foolish people who don't know how to do things. I should appreciate wisdom. Verse 7, "I have seen slaves on horses and princes walking on the ground like slaves." And he's saying again, it shouldn't be this way. Okay, so all of this in 9:13 through 10:7 is commending wisdom. So notice again how 9:13 starts with "I have seen," and then 10:7 starts with "I have seen." That brackets that whole unit. You notice that the next verse, if you're looking at the ESV like I am, the next verse is set like it's poetry. It's not set like prose, like paragraph style. The lines are indented, and this is recognizing that what follows here in chapter 10, really 10:8 through 20, are going to be these proverbial poetic statements, and all of these statements are designed to help people work with wisdom. So it's almost like Solomon is saying, I'm gonna teach my audience now. I'm gonna give you a representative set of examples of what it looks like to work with wisdom and shrewdness. It's kind of like he says, work smarter, not harder, and work with wisdom, not folly. That's what he's gonna go into now. So he's gonna make these observations that are intended to be taken by us and then applied appropriately to whatever work we engage in. So 10:8. "He who digs a pit will fall into it, and a serpent will bite him who breaks through a wall." Now, why does he say this? I think he says this so that people who dig pits will recognize there's a danger of me falling into that. And when I dig a pit, I need to take care. And so that people who break through walls will recognize I don't know what I'm going to find when I break through that wall. So when I get ready to break through that wall, I need to be ready for things like serpents. So he's making observations that are intended to be used by us to prepare for the unexpected as we work. Verse 9, he who quarries stones is hurt by them, and he who splits logs is endangered by them. Again, it's an observation that is intended to enable those who quarry stones or split logs to take appropriate care. Verse 10, if the iron is blunt and one does not sharpen the edge, he must use more strength. So it's kind of like he says, look, I know you don't want to take the time to sharpen the edge. I know you don't want to be bothered with the maintenance of your equipment, but you need to recognize that if you don't maintain that equipment, if you don't sharpen that edge, it's going to cost you more time in the long run. And if you take the time to sharpen your equipment, if you take the time, I mean, I don't know if this happens to you, you come to the kitchen counter and there's this mound of dirty dishes, and then maybe you've washed dishes by hands and you've piled them up in the other side of the sink to dry. And you think to yourself, I don't want to take the time to put that stuff away. I'll just wash all these other dishes and stack them on top. And the next thing you know, one slides off the top and shatters, and now you got a bigger mess to clean up. This is the kind of, Solomon wants us to apply wisdom and recognize it's actually going to save me time to put this pile away before I start working on this other pile. That this kind of wisdom can be applied all through life. I'm a person that works at a computer, and I write books. And sometimes I come to my table and stuff is stacked everywhere. And there are all these books that I left open, and there are all these papers and articles that I've left out. And I think to myself, I'm not going to take the time to put that stuff away. And as a result, everything is cluttered. I can't find anything. And all that clutter, it starts to affect me and it clouds my own thinking. And I need to recognize if I actually clean things up, I'd have a more tidy environment, and I would probably be able to think more clearly and find what I need when I need it. If the iron is blunt and one does not sharpen the edge, he must use more strength. My wife is sitting here, and she's going to hold me accountable to what I'm talking about here. Wisdom helps one to succeed. Verse 11, if the serpent bites before it is charmed, there is no advantage to the charmer. So this is an observation about you know, if you've got the ability to charm something like a serpent, you can't wait to apply that ability. You need to recognize that thing could strike me. Verse 12, the words of a wise man's mouth win him favor, but the lips of a fool consume him. I think what Solomon is doing is making the kind of observation that is intended to cause his audience to say, how do I become someone who's wise? So that the words of my mouth win me favor. How do I become someone who is wise so that when I open my mouth, my lips don't ruin me? What comes out of my mouth doesn't ruin my life. One of the things that comes through in Solomon's teaching is that you should seek advice. You should seek counsel. You know, he says in Proverbs, in many counselors there is victory. And it is not a sign of weakness to say to people who know how to do things or who have experience that you need, I'd like your counsel on how I should pursue this. I'd like you. I'll give you an example from my life. I work for Dr. Moeller at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and recently I had an idea, and I wanted my idea to be Dr. Moeller's idea. And so I called a guy that worked with Dr. Moeller for a long time, had a lot of experience with him, and I said to my friend, how do I make one of my ideas Dr. Moeller's ideas? And he just gave me a script. He said, this is how you need to pursue this. This is exactly what you need to say. This is exactly what you need to do. This is what Dr. Moeller is concerned about. And I got an opportunity to Dr. Moeller, and I followed the script, and it was awesome. I mean, it was amazing. He was like, this is a great idea. We should do this. Let's do this. Let's make this happen. And I'm like, praise the Lord for Solomon's wisdom. Verse 13, The beginning of the words of his mouth, this is talking about the fool, is foolishness, and the end of his talk is evil madness. A fool multiplies words, though no man knows what is to be. Notice that no man knows there. And who can tell him what will be after him? The toil of a fool wearies him, for he does not know the way to the city. And again, these are observations that all this does not know stuff. These are observations that are intended to help us think through how to do our work with wisdom. Now, I'm gonna skip over the proverbial instructions that run through the end of chapter 10 and move ahead to chapter 11 because our time is slipping away. And I'd invite you to look at 11:1 with me, this somewhat enigmatic statement where Solomon says, "Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days." And then he says, "Give a portion to seven or even to eight, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth." Now, these are statements that need a context. And so I think the context that Solomon intends us to interpret these statements in is a context of the shipping out of resources. So imagine a situation where someone has grown a lot of grain or wheat or something that's going to be used to make bread. And what Solomon is saying is, when he says, cast your bread upon the waters, he's saying, invest that stuff, ship that stuff out, for you will find it after many days. Meaning, you send out what you've reaped, and then it's going to bring back a return on your investment. And then when he says, give a portion to seven or even to eight, it's like he's saying, you need to diversify your investments. You don't need to put all your eggs into one basket. You don't need to put all your wheat or your grain onto one ship, for you know not what disaster may happen on the earth. That one ship may go down. That one market may not be ripe for buying grain. So diversify it, put it in seven or eight different ships, and then your return on your investment is going to come back at the appropriate time. Verse 11. Again, these are somewhat enigmatic statements that need a context in which to be interpreted. So chapter 11, verse 3, if the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. And if a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. Okay, thanks, Solomon. Appreciate that. You know, it's remarkable. R.C. Sproul was actually converted on Ecclesiastes chapter 11, verse 3. He said he thinks he's probably the only person in the history of the church that came to faith because of this observation. If a tree falls to the north or to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. But that's the verse the Lord used to bring him to faith. Here's what I think Solomon is doing. I think he's saying, you need to look at creation and you need to learn how creation works. And you need to recognize that you're going to have to deal with creation. So you need to be able to look at the sky and recognize it looks like it's going to rain. And if the clouds are full, it is going to rain. And then you need to respond with wisdom to the rain. If the tree falls, there it's going to lie. And if your job is to work and keep the garden, you're going to need to deal with the tree. So I think he's saying, look at the world, learn the way the world works, and don't think to yourself, oh, I'm going to be the exception. The clouds are going to fill up, but it's not going to rain on me. The tree looks like it's rotted, but it's not going to fall on something that I care about. No, you need to recognize that thing's probably going to fall, and I'm going to have to deal with it. And if it looks like it's going to fall, I shouldn't park my car underneath it, you know, something like this. But then there's sort of a counterbalancing statement in verse 4. He who observes the wind will not sow. Okay, so this is envisioning someone who is so concerned about when he lets go of the seed, where the wind is going to blow the seed, that he never decides, I've got to go to work. He's always looking at the wind, and he's always concluding, well, the conditions are not right. There's too much wind. The seed's not going to go where I want it to go. And so he remarks, it's kind of like he says, look, at some point, you just got to go out there and work. Get after it. You got to go throw the seed in spite of the wind. And then he says, he who regards the clouds will not reap. And so this is responding to the person who's overcautious about the clouds. Well, it's time to reap, but looks like it's going to rain today, so maybe I shouldn't do that. And he's like, look, there's a balance here. You need to recognize if the clouds are full, it's going to rain, but you also need to recognize I can't be paralyzed by that possibility. Verses 5 and 6, there's going to be a threefold repetition of this, you do not know. As you do not know the way the Spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. In the morning, sow your seed, and at evening, withhold not your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. Okay, so that threefold repetition of you do not know, it punctuates, it marks the end of that section, which is all dealing with wisdom at work. The final section of the book that starts in 11:7 and it continues through 12:14 is about how we respond to the change that happens in our bodies that ends in death. And I think the kind of teaching that Solomon is giving here is a kind of teaching that says, look, you need to embrace the reality that you're going to get old and die. You need to recognize and not kick against the fact that you're a human being, your body's going to change, you're going to break down, and you're going to come to the end. And so what he does is he starts in 11:7. He says, light is sweet, and it's pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. But let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is breath. So it's kind of like he's using light as a metaphor for the sun, the sunrise of your life and the full day. And then at the sunset of your life, you need to recognize the days of darkness will be many. And then he continues, verse 9, rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, but know that for all these things God will bring you into judgment. This is not a recommendation of sinful, carnal, hedonistic, fleshly pleasure. This is a recommendation of godly pleasure. This is a recommendation. He's saying, look, you're going to come into judgment, so enjoy yourself in a righteous way. Enjoy your youth and your strength righteously. And there's a little bit of, look, the sunset's coming, so enjoy the sunrise. Enjoy the full day. Verse 10, remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are, we could say, breath or a vapor. They're brief. Youth and the dawn of life are, I don't think vanity is the best way to put this. I think it would be better to say vapor or breath. 12:1. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth. It's like he's saying, know God. Know God and enjoy righteous pleasures. And then he goes on to describe the decline, the way that it's like he uses the metaphor of a grand house that where there was all this activity, and gradually the windows are shut up, and it's like we lose our eyesight, and all the activity comes to a standstill. And people that were once big and strong and bold, they're bent over. And people that were once fast and active, they're dragging themselves along because they're no longer able to recover from physical activity. And he's saying, I think we need to embrace this with wisdom. Don't be somebody that refuses to accept the human condition. Be someone who says, all in God's time. All is beautiful. Chapter 3, he makes all things beautiful in his time. We are over time. I apologize to you. Last word I'll say is that the book closes with this admonition to fear God and keep his commandments, for God will bring every deed into judgment. So we want to be mindful of the coming judgment. We want to fear God in response to the knowledge of it. And we want to learn that the way to life, the way to joy, the way to righteous pleasure is the way of obedience. That's wisdom. Let's pray. Father, we ask that you would help us to embrace the teaching of the book of Ecclesiastes, and we pray that you would help us to be wise people who live in Christ-like ways that are pleasing to you, and we ask this in the name of the Lord Jesus. Amen.